The snow cat plunged down the embankment to the Swanee Pond Road fast enough to make Henry's stomach roll over. It slewed, then turned south. Owen worked the clutch and mangled the stick shift, working the cat up through the gears and into high. With the galaxies of snow flying at the windshield, Henry felt as if they were traveling at approximately Mach 1. He guessed it might actually be 35 miles an hour. That would get them away from Goslin's, but he had an idea Jonesy was moving much faster. "Turnpike ahead?" Owen asked. "It is, isn't it?" "Yes, about 4 miles." "We'll need to switch vehicles when we get there." "No one gets hurt if we can help it, and no one gets killed." "Henry, I don't know how to break it to you, but this isn't high school basketball. No one gets hurt. No one gets killed, at least not while we're swapping vehicles. Agree to that, or I'm rolling out this door right now." Owen glanced at him. "You would, too, wouldn't you? And goddamn what your friend's got planned for the world. My friend isn't responsible for any of this. He's been kidnapped." "All right. No one gets hurt when we swap over, if we can help it. And no one gets killed, except maybe us. Now, where are we going?" "Derry." "That's where he is? This last surviving alien?" "I think so. In any case, I have a friend in Derry who can help us. He sees the line." "What line?" "Never mind," Henry said and thought. "It's complicated." "What do you mean, complicated? And no bounce, no play. What's that?" "I'll tell you while we're driving south, if I can." The snowcat rolled toward the interstate, a capsule preceded by the glare of its lights. "Tell me again what we're going to do," Owen said.
"Save the world."
"And tell me what that makes us. I need to hear it." "It makes us heroes," Henry said. Then he put his head back and closed his eyes. In seconds, he was asleep.
Part 3. Quabbin. As I was going up the stair, I met a man who wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. I wish he'd stay away. Use Mairns.
Chapter 18. The Chase Begins. Jonesy had no idea what time it was when the green Dysart's sign twinkled out of the snowy gloom. The Ram's dashboard clock was bitched up, just flashing 12 a.m. over and over. But it was still dark and still snowing hard. Outside of Derry, the plows were losing their battle with the storm. The stolen ram was a pretty good goer, as Jonesy's pop would have said, but it too was losing its battle, slipping and slewing more frequently in the deepening snow, fighting its way through the drifts with increasing difficulty. Jonesy had no idea where Mr. Gray thought he was going, but Jonesy didn't believe he would get there. Not in this storm. Not in this truck. The radio worked, but not very well. So far, everything that came through was faint, blurred with static. He heard no time checks, but picked up a weather report. The storm had switched over to rain from Portland south, but from Augusta to Brunswick, the radio said, the precipitation was a wicked mix of sleet and freezing rain. Most communities were without power, and nothing without chains on its wheels was moving. Jonesy liked this news just fine. When Mr. Gray turned the steering wheel to head up the ramp toward the beckoning green sign, the ram pickup slid broadside, spraying up great clouds of snow. Jonesy knew he likely would have gone off the exit ramp and into the ditch if he'd been in control, but he wasn't. And although he was no longer immune to Jonesy's emotions, Mr. Gray seemed much less prone to panic in a stress situation. Instead of wrenching blindly against the skid, Mr. Gray turned into it, held the wheel over until the slide stopped, then straightened the truck out again. The dog, sleeping in the passenger footwell, never woke up, and Jonesy's pulse barely rose. If he had been in control, Jonesy knew, his heart would have been hammering like hell. But of course, his idea of what to do with the car when it stormed like this was to put it in the garage. Mr. Gray obeyed the stop sign at the top of the ramp, although Route 9 was a drifted wasteland in either direction. Across from the ramp was a huge parking lot brilliantly lit by arc sodiums. Beneath their glare, The wind-driven snow seemed to move like the frozen respiration of an enormous, unseen beast. On an ordinary night, Jonesy knew, that yard would have been full of rumbling diesel semis, Kenworths and Macs and Jimmy Pete's, with their green and amber cab lights glimmering. Tonight, the area was almost deserted, except for the area marked long-term sea yard manager must have ticket. In there were a dozen or more freight haulers, their edges softened by the drifts. Inside, their drivers would be eating, playing pinball, watching Spankavision in the trucker's lounge, or trying to sleep in the grim dormitory out back, where $10 got you a cot, a clean blanket, and a scenic view of a cinder block wall. All of them, no doubt, thinking the same two thoughts. When can I roll, and how much is this going to cost me? Mr. Gray stepped down on the gas, and although he did it gently, as Jonesy's file concerning winter driving suggested, all four of the pickup's wheels spun, and the truck began to jitter sideways, digging itself in. "Go on," Jonesy cheered from his position at the office window. "Go on, stick it. Stick it right up to the rocker panels, because when you're stuck in a four-wheel drive, you're really stuck." Then the wheels caught. First the front ones, where the weight of the motor gave the ram a little more traction, then the back ones. The ram trundled across Route 9 and toward the sign marked Entrance. Beyond it was another. "Welcome to the best truck stop in New England." Then the truck's headlights picked out a third, snow-caked but readable. Hell, welcome to the best truck stop on Earth. "Is this the best truck stop on Earth?" Mr. Gray asked. "Of course," Jonesy said. And then, he couldn't help it, he burst out laughing. "Why do you do that? Why do you make that sound?" Jonesy realized an amazing thing, both touching and terrifying. Mr. Gray was smiling with Jonesy's mouth. Not much, just a little, but it was a smile. "He doesn't really know what laughter is," Jonesy thought. Of course, he hadn't known what anger was either, but he had proved to be a remarkably fast learner. He could now tantrum with the best of them. "What you said struck me funny. What exactly is funny?" Jonesy had no idea how to answer the question. He wanted Mr. Gray to experience the entire gamut of human emotions, suspecting that humanizing his usurper might ultimately be his only chance of survival. "We have met the enemy, and he is us," Pogo had once said. But how did you explain funny to a collection of spores from another world? And what was funny about Dysart's proclaiming itself the best truck stop on Earth? Now they were passing yet another sign, one with little arrows pointing left and right. "Biggins," it said beneath the left arrow, and "Littlins" under the right. "Which are we?" Mr. Gray asked, stopping at the sign. Jonesy could have made him retrieve the information, but what would have been the point? "We're a Littlin," he said. And Mr. Gray turned the ram to the right. The tires spun a little, and the truck lurched. Lad raised his head, let fly another long and fragrant fart, then whined. His lower midsection had swelled and distended. Anyone who didn't know better would no doubt have mistaken him for a bitch about to give birth to a good-sized litter. There were perhaps 24 cars and pickups parked in the Littlin's lot, the ones most deeply buried in snow belonging to the help. Mechanics, always one or two on duty, waitresses, short-order cooks. The cleanest vehicle there, Jonesy saw with sharp interest, was a powder-blue state police car with packed snow around the roof lights. Being arrested would certainly put a spike in Mr. Gray's plans. On the other hand, Jonesy had already been present at 3 murder sites, if you counted the cab of the pickup. No witnesses at the first 2 crime scenes, and probably no Gary Jones fingerprints either. But here? Sure. Plenty of them. He could see himself standing in a courtroom somewhere and saying, "But Judge, it was the alien inside me who committed those murders. It was Mr. Gray." Another joke that Mr. Gray wouldn't get. That worthy, meanwhile, had been rummaging again. "Dry farts," he said. "Why do you call this place Dry Farts when the sign says Dysart's?" "It's what Lamar used to call it," Jonesy said, remembering long, hilarious breakfasts here, usually going or coming back from Hole in the Wall. And this fit right into the tradition, didn't it? "My dad called it that, too." "Is it funny?" "Moderately, I guess. It's a pun based on similar sounds. Puns are what we call the lowest form of humor. Mr. Gray parked in the rank closest to the lighted island of the restaurant, but all the way down from the state police cruiser. Jonesy had no idea if Mr. Gray understood the significance of the light bars on top or not. He reached for the ram's headlight knob and pushed it in. He reached for the ignition, then stopped and issued several hard barks of laughter.
Ha! 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 Ha!
How'd that feel? Jonesy asked. More than a little curious, a little apprehensive, too. Like nothing, Mr. Gray said flatly, and turned off the ignition. But then, sitting there in the dark with the wind howling around the cab of the truck, he did it again, and with a little more conviction.
Ha! 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 Ha!
In his office refuge, Jonesy shivered. It was a creepy sound, like a ghost trying to remember how to be human. Lad didn't like it either. He whined again, looking uneasily at the man behind the steering wheel of his master's truck. Owen was shaking Henry awake, and Henry responded reluctantly. He felt as if he had gone to sleep only seconds ago. His limbs all seemed to have been dipped in cement. Henry, I'm here. Left leg itching, mouth itching even worse. The goddamn virus was growing on his lips now, too. He rubbed it off with his forefinger, surprised at how easily it broke free, like a crust. Listen up and look. Can you look? Henry looked up the road, which was now dim and snow-ghostly. Owen had pulled the snowcat over and turned off the lights. Farther along, there were mental voices in the dark, the auditory equivalent of a campfire. Henry went to them. There were four of them, young men with no seniority in... Blue Group, Owen whispered. This time, we're Blue Group. Four young men with no seniority in Blue Group, trying not to be scared, trying to be tough. Voices in the dark. A little campfire of voices in the dark. By its light, Henry discovered that he could see dimly. Snow, of course, and a few flashing yellow lights illuminating a turnpike entrance ramp. There was also the lid of a pizza carton seen in the light of an instrument panel. It had been turned into a tray. On it were saltines, several blocks of cheese, and a Swiss Army knife. The Swiss Army knife belonged to the one named Smitty, and they were all using it to cut the cheese. The longer Henry looked, the better he saw. It was like having your eyes adjust to the dark, but it was more than that, too. What he saw had a creepy, giddy depth, as if all at once the physical world consisted not of three dimensions, but of four or five. It was easy enough to understand why he was seeing through four sets of eyes all at the same time. They were huddled together in the Humvee, Owen said, delighted. It's a fucking Humvee, Henry. Custom equipped for snow, too. Bet you anything it is. The young men were sitting close together, yes, but still in four different places, looking at the world from four different points of view, and with four different qualities of eyesight, ranging from Eagle Eye Sharp, Dana from Maybrook, New York, to the merely adequate. Yet somehow Henry's brain was processing them, just as it turned multiple still images on a reel of film into a moving picture. This wasn't like a movie, though, nor like some tricky 3D image. It was an entirely new way of seeing, the kind that could produce a whole new way of thinking. If this shit spreads, Henry thought, both terrified and wildly excited, if it spreads... Owen's elbow thumped into his side. Maybe you could save the seminar for another day, he said. Look across the road. Henry did so, employing his unique quadruple vision and realizing only belatedly that he had done more than look. He had moved their eyeballs so he could peer over to the far side of the turnpike, where he saw more blinking lights in the storm. It's a choke point, Owen muttered. One of Kurtz's insurance policies. Both exits blocked. No movement onto the turnpike without authorization. I want the Humvee. It's the best thing we could have in a shitstorm like this, but I don't want to alert the guys on the other side. Can we do that? Henry experimented with their eyes again, moving them. He discovered that as soon as they weren't all looking at the same thing, his sense of godlike 4- or 5-dimensional vision evaporated, leaving him with a nauseating, shattered perspective his processing equipment couldn't cope with. But he was moving then. Not much, just their eyeballs. But I think we can if we work together, Henry told him. Get closer, and stop talking out loud. Get in my head. Link up. Suddenly Henry's head was fuller. His vision clarified again, but this time the perspective wasn't quite as deep. Only 2 sets of eyes instead of 4, his and Owen's. Owen put the snowcat into first gear and crept forward with the lights off. The engine's low growl was lost beneath the constant shriek of the wind, and as they closed the distance, Henry felt his hold on those mines up ahead tightening. Holy shit, Owen said, half laughing and half gasping. What? What is it? It's you, man. It's like being on a magic carpet. Christ, but you're strong. You think I'm strong, wait till you meet Jonesy. Owen stopped the snowcat below the brow of a little hill. Beyond it was the turnpike, not to mention Bernie, Dana, Tommy, and Smitty, sitting in their Humvee at the top of the southbound ramp, eating cheese and crackers off their makeshift tray. He and Owen were safe enough from discovery. The 4 young men in the Humvee were clean of the virus and had no idea they were being scoped. Ready? Henry asked. I guess. The other person in Henry's head, cool as that storied cucumber when Kurtz and the others had been shooting at them, was now nervous. You take the lead, Henry. I'm just flying support this mission. Here we go. What Henry did next, he did instinctively, binding the 4 men in the Humvee together not with images of death and destruction, but by impersonating Kurtz. To do this, he drew on both Owen Underhill's energy, much greater than his own at this point, and Owen Underhill's vivid knowledge of his OIC. The act of binding gave him a brilliant stab of satisfaction. Relief as well. Moving their eyes was one thing. Taking them over completely was another. And they were free of the virus. That could have made them immune. Thank God it had not.
There's a snowcat over that rise east of you laddies, Kurtz replied at last.
I know. They headed south in the Humvee, south into the storm. Henry Devlin was still gobbling crackers and cheese when exhaustion turned out the lights in his overstimulated head. He slept with crumbs on his lips and dreamed of Josie Rinkenhauer. Half an hour after it caught fire, old Reggie Goslin's barn was no more than a dying dragon's eye in the booming night, waxing and waning in a black socket of melted snow. From the woods, east of the Swanee Pond Road, came the pop, pop, pop of rifle fire, heavy at first, then diminishing a little in both frequency and volume as the Imperial Valleys, Kate Gallagher's Imperial Valleys now, pursued the escaped detainees. It was a turkey shoot, and not many of the turkeys were going to get away. Enough of them to tell the tale, maybe, enough to rat them all out. But that was tomorrow's worry. While this was going on, also while the traitorous Owen Underhill was getting farther and farther ahead of them, Kurtz and Freddie Johnson stood in the command post, except Freddie supposed it was now nothing but a Winnebago again, that feeling of power and importance had gone, flipping playing cards into a hat. No longer telepathic in the slightest, but as sensitive to the men under him as ever, that his command had been reduced to a single soldier really made no difference, Kurtz looked at Freddie and said, "Make haste slowly, Buck. That's one saw that's still sharp." "Yes, boss," Freddie said without much enthusiasm. Kurtz flipped the 2 of spades. It fluttered down through the air and landed in the hat. Kurtz crowed like a child and prepared to flip again. There was a knock at the Bago's door. Freddie turned in that direction, and Kurtz fixed him with a forbidding look. Freddie turned back and watched Kurtz flip another card. This one started out well, then went long and landed on the cap's bill. Kurtz muttered something under his breath, then nodded at the door. Freddie, with a mental prayer of thanks, went to open it. Standing on the top step was Jocelyn McAvoy, one of the 2 female Imperial Valleys. Her accent was soft country Tennessee, The face under the boy-cropped blonde hair was hard as stone. She was holding a spectacularly non-reg Israeli burp gun by the strap. Freddy wondered where she'd gotten such a thing, then decided it didn't matter. A lot of things had ceased to matter, most of them, in the last hour or so.
"Joss," Freddy said, "what's up with your bad self?"
"Delivering 2 Ripley positives as ordered."
More shooting from the woods, and Freddy saw the woman's eyes shift minutely in that direction. She wanted to get back over there across the road, wanted to bag her limit before the game was gone. Freddy knew how she felt.
"Send them in, lassie," Kurtz said.
He was still standing over the cap on the floor that was still faintly stained with Cook's 3rd Melrose's blood, still holding the deck of cards in his hand, but his eyes were bright and interested.
"Let's see who you found."
Jocelyn gestured with her gun. A male voice at the foot of the stairs growled,
"The fuck up there. Don't make me say it twice."
The first man to step past Jocelyn was tall and very black. There was a cut down one of his cheeks and another on his neck. Both cuts had been clogged with Ripley. More was growing in the creases in his brow. Freddy knew the face, but not the name. The old man, of course, knew both. Freddy supposed he remembered the names of all the men he had commanded, both the quick and the dead.
"Cambry," Kurtz said, eyes lighting even more brightly.
He dropped the playing cards into the hat, approached Cambry, seemed about to shake hands, thought better of it, and snapped off a salute instead. Jean Cambry did not return it. He looked sullen and disoriented.
"Welcome to the Justice League of America."
"Spotted him running through the woods along with the detainees he was supposed to be guarding," Jocelyn McAvoy said.
Her face was expressionless. All her contempt was in her voice.
"Why not?" Cambry asked. He looked at Kurtz. "You were going to kill me anyway. Kill all of us. Don't bother lying about it either. I can see it in your mind."
Kurtz wasn't discomfited by this in the slightest. He rubbed his hands together and smiled at Cambry in a friendly way.
"Do a good job, and perhaps you'll change my mind, Buck. Hearts were made to be broken, and minds were made to be changed. That's a big praise God. Who else you got for me, Joss?"
Freddy regarded the second figure with amazement, also with pleasure. The Ripley could not have found a better home, in his humble opinion. Nobody liked the son of a bitch much in the first place.
"Sir, boss, I don't know why I'm here. I was in proper pursuit of the SKPs when when this officious bitch pulled me out of the sweep area, and..."
"He was running with them," McAvoy said in a bored voice. "Running with them and infecting up the old wazoo."
"A lie," said the man in the doorway. "A total lie. I'm perfectly clean, 100%.
McAvoy snatched off the watch cap her second prisoner was wearing. The man's thinning blonde hair was much thicker now and appeared to have been dyed red.
"I can explain, sir," Archie Perlmutter said, his voice fading even as he spoke. "There is, you see..."
Then it died away entirely. Kurtz was beaming at him. But he had donned his filter mask again, they all had, and it gave his reassuring smile an oddly sinister look, the expression of a child molester inviting a little kid in for a piece of pie.
"Pearly, it's going to be all right," Kurtz said. "We're going for a ride, that's all. There's someone we need to find. Someone you know."
"Owen Underhill," Perlmutter whispered.
"That's right, Buck," Kurtz said. He turned to McAvoy. "Bring this soldier his clipboard, McAvoy. I'm sure he'll feel better once he has his clipboard. Then you can carry on hunting, which I feel quite sure you're eager to do."
"Yes, boss.
But first, watch this. A little trick I learned back in Kansas."
Kurtz sprayed the cards. In the crazy blizzard wind coming through the door, they flew every which way. Only one landed face up in the hat. But it was the ace of spades. Mr. Gray held the menu, looking at the lists of stuff. Meatloaf, sliced beets, roast chicken, chocolate silk pie, with interest and an almost total lack of understanding. Jonesy realized it wasn't just not knowing how food tasted.
Mr. Gray didn't know what taste was. How could he? When you cut to the chase, he was nothing but a mushroom with a high IQ. Here came a waitress, moving under a vast tableland of frozen ash-blonde hair. The badge on her not-inconsiderable bosom read, "Welcome to Dysart's. I am your waitress, Darlene." "Hi, hon. What can I get you?"
"I'd like scrambled eggs and bacon. Crisp, not limp."
"Toast?
How about canned pigs?"
She raised her eyebrows and looked at him over her pad. Beyond her, at the counter, the state trooper was eating some kind of drippy sandwich and talking with the short order cook.
"Sorry, cake pans, I meant to say."
The eyebrows went higher. Her question was plain, blinking at the front of her mind like a neon sign in a saloon window. Was this guy a mushmouth, or was he making fun of her? Standing at his office window, smiling, Jonesy relented.
"Pancakes," Mr. Gray said.
"Uh-huh. I sort of figured. Coffee with that?"
"Please."
She snapped her pad closed and started away. Mr. Gray was back at the locked door of Jonesy's office at once, and furious all over again.
"How could you do that?" he asked. "How could you do that from in there?"
An ill-natured thump as Mr. Gray hit the door. And he was more than angry, Jonesy realized. He was frightened as well, because if Jonesy could interfere, everything was in jeopardy.
"I don't know," Jonesy said, and truthfully enough. "But don't take it so hard. Enjoy your breakfast. I was just fucking with you a little."
"Why?"
Still furious, still drinking from the well of Jonesy's emotions and liking it in spite of himself.
"Why would you do that?"
"Call it payback for trying to roast me in my office while I was sleeping," Jonesy said.
With the restaurant section of the truck stop almost deserted, Darlene was back with the food in no time. Jonesy considered seeing if he could gain control of his mouth long enough to say something outrageous.
"Darlene, can I bite your hair?"
was what came to mind, and thought better of it. She set his plate down, gave him a dubious look, then started away. Mr. Gray, looking at the bright yellow lump of eggs and the dark twigs of bacon, not just crispy but almost incinerated in the great Dysart's tradition, through Jonesy's eyes, was feeling the same dubiety.
"Go on," Jonesy said.
He was standing at his office window, watching and waiting with amusement and curiosity. Was it possible that the bacon and eggs would kill Mr. Gray? Probably not, but it might at least make the hijacking motherfucker good and sick.
"Go on, Mr. Gray, eat up. Bon fucking appetit."
Mr. Gray consulted Jonesy's files and the proper use of the silverware, then picked up a tiny clot of scrambled eggs on the tines of his fork and put them in Jonesy's mouth. What followed was both amazing and hilarious. Mr. Gray gobbled everything in huge bites, pausing only to drown the pancakes in fake maple syrup. He loved it all, but most particularly, the bacon. "Flesh," Jonesy heard him exulting. It was almost the voice of the creature in one of those corny old monster movies from the 30s.
"Flesh! Flesh! This is the taste of flesh!"
Funny, but maybe not all that funny either. Maybe sort of horrible. The cry of a new-made vampire. Mr. Gray looked around, ascertained that he wasn't being watched. The state bear was now addressing a large piece of cherry pie, then picked up the plate and licked the grease from it with big swipes of Jonesy's tongue. He finished by licking the sticky syrup from the ends of his fingers. Darlene returned, poured more coffee, looked at the empty dishes.
"Why, you get a gold star," she said. "Anything else?"
"More bacon," Mr. Gray said. He consulted Jonesy's files for the correct terminology and added,
"A double order?"
"And may you choke on it," Jonesy thought, but now without much hope.
"Gotta stoke the stove," Darlene said.
A comment Mr. Gray didn't understand and didn't bother hunting down in Jonesy's files. He put two sugars in his coffee, looked around to make sure he wasn't observed, then poured the contents of a third packet down his throat. Jonesy's eyes half closed for a few seconds as Mr. Gray drowned happily in the bliss of sweet.
"You can have that any time you want it," Jonesy said through the door.
Now he supposed he knew how Satan felt when he took Jesus up on the mountaintop and tempted him with all the cities of the earth. Not good. Not really bad. Just doing the job. Selling the product. Except, check that. It did feel good, because he knew he was getting through. He wasn't opening stab wounds exactly, but he was at least pricking Mr. Gray, making him sweat little blood beads of desire. Give it up, Jonesy coaxed. Go native. You can spend years exploring my senses. They're pretty sharp. I'm still under 40. No reply from Mr. Gray. He looked around, saw no one looking his way, poured fake maple syrup into his coffee, slurped it, and looked around again for his supplemental bacon. Jonesy sighed. This was like being with a strict Muslim who has somehow wound up on a Las Vegas holiday. On the far side of the restaurant was an arch with a sign reading Trucker's Lounge and Showers above it. In the short hallway beyond, there was a bank of pay telephones. Several drivers stood there, no doubt explaining to spouses and bosses that they wouldn't be back on time. They'd been shut down by a surprise storm in Maine. They were at Dysart's truck stop, known to the cognoscenti as Dry Farts, Jonesy thought, south of Derry, and here they would likely remain until at least noon tomorrow. Jonesy turned from the office window with its view of the truck stop and looked at his desk, now covered with all his old and comforting clutter. There was his phone, the blue trim line. Would it be possible to call Henry on it? Was Henry even still alive? Jonesy thought he was. He thought that if Henry were dead, he would have felt the moment of his passing. More shadows in the room, perhaps. Elvis has left the building, Beaver had often said when he spotted a name he knew in the obits. What a fucking pisser. Jonesy didn't think Henry had left the building just yet. It was even possible that Henry had an encore in mind. Mr. Gray didn't choke on his second order of bacon, but when his lower belly suddenly cramped up, he let out a dismayed roar. You poisoned me! Relax, Jonesy said. You just need to make a little room, my friend. Room? What do you... He broke off as another cramp gripped his gut. I mean that we had better hurry along to the little boy's room, Jonesy said. Good God, didn't all those abductions you guys did in the 60s teach you anything about the human anatomy? Darlene had left the check, and Mr. Gray picked it up. Leave a 15% on the table, Jonesy said. It's a tip. How much is 15%? Jonesy sighed. These were the masters of the universe that the movies had taught us to fear? Merciless, star-faring conquerors who didn't know how to take a shit or figure a tip? Another cramp, plus a fairly silent fart. It smelled, but not of ether. Thank God for small favors, Jonesy thought. Then to Mr. Gray, show me the check. Jonesy looked at the green slip of paper through his office window. Leave her a buck and a half. And when Mr. Gray seemed dubious, this is good advice I'm giving you, my friend. More, and she remembers you as the night's big tipper. Less, and she remembers you as a chintz. He sensed Mr. Gray checking for the meaning of chintz in Jonesy's files. Then, without further argument, he left a dollar and two quarters on the table. With that taken care of, he headed for the cash register, which was on the way to the men's room. The cop was working on his pie with slightly suspicious slowness, Jonesy thought, and as they passed him, Jonesy felt Mr. Gray as an entity, an ever more human entity, dissolve, going out to peek inside the cop's head. Nothing out there now but the red-black cloud running Jonesy's various maintenance systems. Quick as a flash, Jonesy grabbed the phone on his desk. For a moment he hesitated, unsure. Just dial 1-800-HENRY, Jonesy thought. For a moment, there was nothing. And then, in some other somewhere, a phone began to ring.
Pete's idea, Henry muttered.
Owen, at the wheel of the Humvee, it was huge and it was loud, but it was equipped with oversized snow tires and rode the storm like the QE2, looked over. Henry was asleep. His glasses had slid down to the end of his nose. His eyelids, now delicately fuzzed with virus, rippled as the eyeballs beneath them moved. Henry was dreaming. About what? Owen wondered. He supposed he could dip into his new partner's head and have a look, but that seemed perverse.
Pete's idea, Henry repeated. Pete saw her first.
And he sighed, a sound so tired that Owen felt bad for him. No, he decided he didn't want any part of what was going on in Henry's head. Another hour to Derry, more if the wind stayed high. Better to just let him sleep. Behind Derry High School is the football field where Richie Grenadeau once strutted his stuff. But Richie is 5 years in his teenage hero's grave, just another small-town car crash James Dean. Other heroes have risen, thrown in their passes, and moved on. It's not football season now anyway. It's spring, and on the field there is a gathering of what look like birds, huge red ones with black heads. These mutant crows are laughing and talking as they sit in their folding chairs, but Mr. Trask, the principal, has no problem being heard. He's at the podium on the makeshift stage, and he's got the mic.
"One last thing before I dismiss you," he booms. "I won't tell you not to throw your mortarboards at the end of the ceremony. I know from years of experience I might as well be talking to myself on that score."
Laughter, cheers, applause.
"But I'm telling you to pick them up and turn them in, or you will be charged for them."
There are a few boos and some raspberries. Beaver Clarendon's the loudest. Mr. Trask gives them a final surveying look.
"Young men and women, members of the class of 82, I think I speak for the entire faculty when I say I'm proud of you. This concludes rehearsal. So..."
The rest is lost, amplification or no amplification. The red crows rise in a gusty flap of nylon, and they fly. Tomorrow, at noon, they will fly for good. Although the three crows laughing and grab-assing their way toward the parking lot where Henry's car is parked did not realize it, the childhood phase of their friendship is now only hours from the end. They don't realize it, and that is probably just as well. Jonesy snatches Henry's mortarboard, slaps it on top of his own, and books for the parking lot.
"Hey, asshole, give that back!" Henry yells.
But then he snatches Beaver's. Beaver squawks like a chicken and runs after Henry, laughing. So the three of them swoop across the grass and behind the bleachers, graduation robes billowing around their jeans. Jonesy has two hats on his head, the tassels swinging in opposite directions. Henry has one, far too big, it's sitting on his ears, and Beaver runs bareheaded, his long black hair flowing out behind him and a toothpick jutting from his mouth. Jonesy is looking back as he runs, taunting Henry.
"Come on, Mr. Basketball, you run like a girl!"
And almost piles into Pete, who is looking at Derry Doins, the glassed-in notice board by the north entrance to the parking lot. Pete, who is graduating from nothing but the junior class this year, grabs Jonesy, bends him backward like a guy doing a tango with some beautiful chick, and kisses him square on the mouth. Both mortarboards tumble off Jonesy's head, and he screams in surprise.
"Queer boy!" Jonesy yells, rubbing frantically at his mouth,
but he's starting to laugh, too. Pete's an oddity. He'll go along quietly for weeks at a time, Norman normal, and then he'll break out and do something nutso. Usually the nutso comes out after a couple of beers, but not this afternoon. "I've always wanted to do that, Gariella," Pete says sentimentally. "Now you know how I really feel."
"Fucking queer boy, if you gave me the sif, I'll kill you."
Henry arrives, snatches his mortarboard off the grass, and swats Jonesy with it.
"There's grass stains on this," Henry says. "If I have to pay for it, I'll do a lot more than just kiss you, Gariella." "Don't make promises you can't keep, fuckwad," Jonesy says.
"Beautiful Gariella," Henry says solemnly. The beeve comes steaming up, puffing around his toothpick. He takes Jonesy's mortarboard, peers into it, and says,
"There's a cum stain on this one. Ain't I seen enough on my own sheets to know?"
He draws in a deep breath and bugles to the departing seniors in their dairy red graduation gowns,
"Gary Jones beats off in his graduation hat. Hey, everybody, listen up. Gary Jones beats off."
Jonesy grabs him, pulls him to the ground, and the two of them roll over and over in billows of red nylon. Both mortarboards are cast off to one side, and Henry grabs them to keep them from getting crushed.
"Get off me," Beaver cries. "You're crushing me, Jesus Christ bananas, for God's sake."
"Duddits knew her," Pete says. He has lost interest in their foolery. Doesn't feel much of their high spirits anyway. Pete is perhaps the only one of them who senses the big changes that are coming. He's looking at the notice board again.
"We knew her, too. She was the one who always stood outside the retard academy. Hi, Duddy," she'd go.
When he says, "Hi, Duddy," Pete's voice goes up high, becomes momentarily girlish in a way that is sweet rather than mocking. And although Pete isn't a particularly good mimic, Henry knows that voice at once. He remembers the girl who had fluffy blonde hair and great brown eyes and scabbed knees and a white plastic purse which contained her lunch and her Barbie Ken. That's what she always called them, Barbie Ken, as if they were a single entity. Jonesy and Beeve also know who Pete's imitating. There is that bond among them. It's been among them for years now. Them and Duddits. Jonesy and the Beeve can't remember the little blonde girl's name any more than Henry can, only that her last one was something impossibly long and clunky. And she had a crush on the Dudster, which was why she always waited for him outside the retard academy. The three of them in their graduation gowns gather around Pete and look at the Derry Doones board. As always, the board is crammed with notices. Bake sales and car washes, tryouts for the community players version of the Fantastics, summer classes at Fenster, the local junior college, plus plenty of hand-printed student ads. Buy this, sell that, need ride to Boston after graduation, looking for roommate in Providence. And way up in the corner, a photo of a smiling girl with acres of blonde hair, frizzy rather than fluffy now, and wide, slightly puzzled eyes. She's no longer a little girl. Henry is surprised again and again by how the children he grew up with, including himself, have disappeared. But he would know those dark and puzzled eyes anywhere. "Missing," says the single block capital word under the photo. And below that, in slightly smaller type, "Josette Rinkenhauer. Last seen, Strawford Park softball field, June 7, 1982. Below this, there is more copy, but Henry doesn't bother reading it. Instead, he reflects on how odd Derry is about missing children, not like other towns at all. This is June 8th, which means the Rinkenhauer girl has only been gone a day, and yet this poster has been tacked way up in the corner of the notice board, or moved there, like somebody's afterthought. Nor is that all. There was nothing in the paper this morning, Henry knows, because he read it, skimmed him through it anyway while he was slurping up his cereal. Maybe it was buried way back in the local section, he thinks, and knows at once, that's it. The key word is buried. Lots of things are buried in Derry. Talk of missing children, for instance. There have been a lot of child disappearances here over the years. These boys know it. It certainly crossed their minds on the day they met Duddits Cavell, but nobody talks much about it. It's as if the occasional missing kid is the price of living in such a nice, quiet place. At this idea, Henry feels a dawning indignation stealing in, first to mix with and then replace his former goofy happiness. She was sweet, too, with her Barbie Ken. Sweet like Duddits. He remembers how the four of them would deliver Duddits to school, all those walks, and how often she'd be outside, Josie Rinkenhauer, with her scabby knees and her great big plastic purse.
Hi, Duddy!
She was sweet. And still is, Henry thinks.
She's alive, Beaver says flatly.
He takes the chewed-up toothpick out of his mouth, looks at it, and drops it to the grass.
Alive and still around, isn't she?
Yeah, Pete says. He's still looking at the picture, fascinated, and Henry knows what Pete is thinking, almost the same thing as he is. She grew up. Even Josie, who in a fairer life might have been Doug Cavell's girlfriend. But I think she's... You know, she's in deep shit, Jonesy says. He has stepped out of his gown and now folds it over his arm.
She's stuck.
Pete says dreamily, still looking at the picture. His finger has begun to go back and forth, tick-tock, tick-tock.
Where? Henry asks.
But Pete shakes his head. So does Jonesy.
Let's ask Duddits,
Beaver says suddenly. And they all know why. There's no need of discussion, because Duddits sees the line. Duddits.
Seize the line!
Henry shouted suddenly, and jerked upright in the passenger seat of the Humvee. It scared the hell out of Owen, who was deep in some private place where there was only him and the storm and the endless line of reflectors to tell him he was still on the road.
Duddits! Seize the line!
The Humvee swerved, skidded, came back under control.
Jesus, man, Owen said. Give me a little warning next time before you blow your top, would you?
Henry ran a hand down his face, drew in a deep breath, and let it out.
I know where we're going and what we have to do.
Well, good.
But I have to tell you a story so you'll understand.
Owen glanced at him. Do you understand?
Not everything, but more than I did.
Go ahead, we've got an hour before Derry. Is that time enough? Henry thought it would be more than enough, especially talking mind to mind. He started at the beginning, what he now understood the beginning to be. Not the coming of the Greys, nor the Byrus, or the Weasels, but four boys who had been hoping to see a picture of the homecoming queen with her skirt pulled up. No more than that. As Owen drove, his mind filled with a series of connected images, more like a dream than a movie. Henry told him about Duddits, about their first trip to Hole in the Wall, and Beaver puking in the snow. He told old Owen about all those walks to school, and about the Duddits' version of the game. They played, and Duddits pegged. About the time they had taken Duddits to see Santa Claus, what a fucking pisser that had been. And about how they had seen Josie Rinkenhauer's picture on the Derry Doohan's board on the day before the three older boys graduated. Owen saw them going to Duddits' house on Maple Lane in Henry's car, the gowns and mortarboard caps piled in back. Saw them saying hi to Mr. and Mrs. Cavell, who were in the living room with an ashy pale man in a Derry gas coverall and a weeping woman. Roberta Cavell has her arm around Ellen Rinkenhauer's shoulders and is telling her it will be all right. She knows that God won't let anything happen to dear little Josie.
It's strong, Owen thought dreamily. Man, what this guy's got is so strong. How can that be?
The Cavells barely look at the boys, because the boys are such frequent visitors here at 19 Maple Lane, and the Rinkenhauers are too deep in their terror to even notice them. They have not touched the coffee Roberta has served.
He's in his room, guys, Alfie Cavell says, giving them a wan smile.
And Duddits, looking up at them from his G.I. Joe figures, he has all of them, gets up as soon as he sees them in the doorway. Duddits never wears his shoes in his room, always his bunny slippers that Henry gave him for his last birthday. He loves the bunny slippers, will wear them until they are nothing but pink rags held together with strapping tape. But his shoes are on now. He's been waiting for them, and although his smile is as sunny as ever, his eyes are serious.
How you going?
Duddits asks.
Where are we going?
And, you were all that way? Owen whispered. He supposed Henry had already told him that, but until now he hadn't understood what Henry meant.
Even before this?
He touched the side of his face, where a thin fuzz of virus was now growing down his cheek.
Yes. No. I don't know. Just be quiet, Owen. Listen.
And Owen's head, once more, filled up with those images from 1982.